is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday. It's time for our weekly Reporters Roundtable program, where we take a look at some of the big stories in Northwest Indiana for the week. And then we're also going to branch out as well outside of the region to take a look at some educational news from south of us. And we start things off taking a look at a lot of things that have happened either in the Lake County Government Center or have affected Lake County government and residents here in the county. And, of course, for that, we turn to a veteran reporter, Lake County Government reporter Bill Dolan with The Times. Bill, thank you once again for joining us here on the show.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you, and a good afternoon to you, too. And let's start out here taking a look at some of the news that makes people shake their heads about Lake County. When we talk about Lake County government, unfortunately, the word, or two words, I suppose, public corruption will sometimes pop up in the conversation. We have another instance of an allegation of that that's come up here lately with a federal court lawsuit, Bill. Tell us about that, please, first.
It's a sexual harassment suit filed by a woman by the name of Estella Montalvo against the Lake County Recorder, Michael B. Brown, not to be confused with the Lake County Clerk, Michael B. Brown, a different Michael Brown. She alleges that she went to work for the Recorder in August of 2014 as a part-time employee, but had told Mr. Mike Brown, the Recorder, that she'd like to have a full-time job with a pension and health care benefits. And the suit says that almost immediately upon her hire, the Recorder began making sexual advances with the implied message that a sexual relationship was a condition of a promotion to a full-time position.
Now, how long had this reportedly been happening, according to the lawsuit?
Well, that's not entirely clear, but it sounds like she was working there from mid-year 2014 until just February, and that this harassment is alleged to have continued for much of that period.
As I remember correctly, that Michael B. Brown, the county recorder, took office, I think, in 2013, right? So it seemed almost to be not quite from the start of his term of office.
That's correct. The election was in 2012, and he would have taken office in 2013. Estelle Montalvo was one of the candidates for that office. Mike Brown won, and she claims that she did have a sexual relationship with him in the hopes of getting that full-time position because there was no other way, apparently.
Now, is this federal court lawsuit that's been filed in the court in Hammond the only thing that's likely to come up as a result of this allegation of some type of relationship here between Ms. Montalvo and Mr. Brown?
Well, there are no criminal charges that have been filed. This is the only lawsuit that I'm aware of, although it alleges that other women, that it involves, this type of behavior involves other women. I will tell your listeners to read the paper this weekend. Mark Chase, my one of my fellows here at the paper, intends to be writing a column about this issue, and expect he'll have a little more about it.
I would imagine so. I would think so, too. And I'm sure, too, there'll probably be matters, even though they may not have surfaced yet and we haven't learned about them, from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, because a lot of times we know that complaints get filed as a result of, because of problems like this that have happened in the workplace.
So I imagine in fact, Ms. Montalvo did file a complaint simultaneously with the EEOC.
Okay, so that's one of the things that may or may not necessarily show up in a court case, but I'm sure that there'll be some kind of ruling, I would imagine, to come down the line sometime, maybe before the matter even goes to court, I suppose.
Well, the EEOC doesn't take many cases, but when they do, their federal lawyers will go after the employer for any form of discrimination. In this case, it would be sexual discrimination. Requiring women to do something that shouldn't be required.
Right. Now, Bill, as far as you know, has Michael B. Brown, the county recorder, had any response to any of this? Or if we know, is he even retained counsel, I guess, to give his side of the story?
Well, he declined comment when I spoke with him earlier this week. I know from Lake County Attorney John Dull that a couple of attorneys will enter the case. The suit names both the recorder and county government overall.
Right.
So a lawyer for each one of those to represent both Mr. Brown and the taxpayers, so to speak, because there is a demand for restitution in this.
I understand too that took a look at the paperwork. It's a very brief complaint, only about 3 pages, I think, and it does call for a trial by jury. So I'm sure that unless the judge and the other side decides that they don't really want to, and they get the judge to agree that it'll be done as a bench trial or something of that sort, that we'll probably end up seeing it in trial before a jury, I would imagine.
Well, a demand for a jury trial is pretty standard.
Yeah.
The vast majority of these types of cases are settled out of court long before a trial, but those do sometimes happen.
Now, since you make visits to the Lake County Government Center on a regular basis, catching the meetings that are regularly scheduled there too, and talking with other people, have you gotten any kind of clue from people that you have talked to there in the building in Crown Point that what they feel about all this matter?
Well, most elected officials don't like to talk about this sort of thing. And they've probably been advised not to do so for fear it'll muddy the case.
Mm-hmm.
There have been all kinds of rumors going around that they have denied that the FBI has been in the building or the Mr. Brown was removed from his office. They say that none of that is true.
Well, I've seen one already published account online talking about the fact that he hadn't been seen for months. And I wonder, is that really the case? Can you really have to rely on your deputy recorder to run the business for you, so to speak, and you not be there?
I'm pretty sure he has not been absent for months. He was just running for re-election last year, so he had to be pretty visible. And I do remember him in at least one or two debates. I have no idea if he has been making himself scarce in recent days. I know there's been negotiations between Ms. Montalvo's lawyers and the county over this matter, but I have no reason to believe that he has disappeared.
Well, I would not imagine it. Certainly wouldn't look good for him to decide to disappear at such a time after with all this that has come out here, especially since we've gotten publicity not only in the Times and other media, including us here. We've had the story on as well, too, talking about this lawsuit that's been filed. So it's best to be around and just kind of let the matter run its course through the courts, I would suppose.
That's what they usually do, whether they're seriously in trouble or not.
Mm. Bill Dolan's with the Times of Northwest Indiana. He covers Lake County government and other matters, too, for the paper. One of the other matters that has come up that's really kind of a combination of Lake County government as well as legislative matters is dealing with the precincts here in Lake County, and in particular making sure that they follow at least what some people feel is the political map of Lake County. Tell us about the reaction here of passage and now enactment of Senate Enrolled Act 220.
Well, it's going to get rid of a lot of precincts. But precincts are these little subdivisions, neighborhoods in many cities where everyone within that boundary goes to a polling place to vote and nowhere else. Those have been around since the dawn of time,
mm-hmm.
and we have about 520 of them, and that's too many, according to the Indiana General Assembly. The population has shifted from Gary, Hammond, and East Chicago, the largest cities, to the suburbs or even out of the county over the years. But these precincts haven't gone away. They're still on the map, and many of them have not many active voters in them. The Senate bill requires that there be at least 600 active voters in a precinct. That will likely cut the number of precincts in Lake County by half, although you can't. It's going to be hard to figure because some precincts are on township boundaries or legislative districts, and you can't just shift a voter into a different township or a different legislative district. But there will be probably scores of these precincts that will be combined with one of their neighbors and be gone, which probably most people won't notice, except unless you're a precinct committeeman. Your precinct will have gone away, and a lot of poll workers, people who work the election polling places, not this year, but in election years, those people will know. There will be fewer people needed to do that, since there will be fewer polling places.
Mm-hmm. Does it look like that those people will be affected, what, maybe a couple years down the road now?
It would be next year.
It would be next year. Okay.
The legislation requires Lake County to do their consolidation by the end of this month.
Oh.
In fact, the election board is meeting Friday to take this matter up. Whether they'll get their work done in that by that deadline is questionable, but nobody seems to know what happens afterwards. The state may take it up and do it for them, or the deadline may pass and they'll continue working on it. It's not really clear at this point.
Now, I know you've talked with both Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser and Lake County Republican Party Chairman Dan Durnell about this and working on your story, and probably have had a chance to find out more from them about this. What do they seem to say about how the process is coming along, since they're up against a deadline now?
Well, they've actually been working on this for some time. The legislation was first introduced earlier this year, and the local election officials had said, let us do it. Don't do it for us.
Mm-hmm.
But the Democrats and Republicans just couldn't agree upon what the low threshold for a precinct. The Democrats wanted a lower one, the Republicans wanted a higher one, and of course the Republicans dominate the state legislature, and they won out. So now it is up to our locals to whatever work they've already done to continue it to an end.
You're listening to the Reporters Roundtable on Thursday here on Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with us on the phone from his office at the Times is Bill Dolan, who's a Lake County government reporter. Looking at some more of the stories that you've worked on, Bill, this week here, and one of them is one, unfortunately, that is very close to a lot of our hearts, which is having to pay our property taxes. Now, a lot of us, I'm certainly in that boat, have some company, basically, I have to send a big check to, it seems, every month to pay the mortgage, and it's supposed to take care of my tax bills, too. But a lot of people I know get the tax bills directly in the mail, and they have that to look forward to. And the deadline to pay was this week.
Wednesday, end of business, which was about 6:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everyone who has paid off their mortgage gets it in the mail, like myself, and you can mail it in or go to your local bank branch or walk it in. A lot of people do line up outside the treasurer's office. Many of them have questions about their bills, or they just like apparently the thought of knowing that they've handed the check directly to the treasurer's people and got a receipt.
Yeah, I know. I see, in fact, in your story that I see from online here, you've noted, I guess, when you stopped in to do more work on the story, that you had a picture of people standing in line there at the treasurer's office with bills in hand and probably their checks as well, too, to get ready to make the payments here. You had a chance to talk with Lake County Treasurer Peggy Katona about this, and I'm sure that maybe in checking back with her, they probably had a very busy day, and certainly right up until the deadline on Wednesday evening.
Yes, in fact, I spoke with her this morning. She said it went very well.
Oh,
people were in a relatively good mood, and no problems. Although I did get a complaint from some gentlemen who tried to pay their taxes last night, apparently after the deadline, and he was trying to pay it online, but they wouldn't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have to have some splaining to do to get his bills paid.
Well, I would imagine so. Yeah, they're very, very insistent that you pay by the deadline. And I don't know if it's something that's just right up to the deadline there that you can get with the treasurer's office and work something out or not.
Well, you could. They have installment plans.
Yeah.
If in fact you don't have the cash altogether, and in fact this is just the spring installment. It's only half of the total. There'll be another installment in early November. But if some people who are really hard up for cash can do it on a monthly basis, But they have to set up a plan with the treasurer.
I mentioned, yeah, you'd have to be able to do that to be able to take care of it. And if they didn't tack the fall installment on, then you still have to at least do the installments to pay off your spring installment to stay up.
There's interest and penalties, and if you wait too long, like 18 months, you can expect to see your house on a tax sale list, which means they'll put your property up for the highest bidder and sell it out from under you.
That's right. We've seen those tax lists. We've seen the ones that have been published because it's a legal document and it has to be published in the Times. We've seen the multi-page separate supplements that have been in the Sunday paper.
It's pretty thick because, of course, they have around 10,000 properties, many of them in Gary, which have been abandoned for years, but they have to recycle them through every time. So nobody will buy them at any price at the moment because of the economic situation there.
I see. One of the other things that you covered this week, I know, was the Lake County Council meeting, and they always take up a lot of matters involving government spending and have some interesting conversations, sometimes debates about whether something should be paid or not or somebody's request should be honored or not. Tell us what happened at the latest council meeting.
Well, they gave preliminary approval to a $12 million bond issue, which is a fancy way of saying they're going to borrow money to do some modernization at the government center in Crown Point, asbestos removal and other improvements of county properties. This was opposed by the two Republican council members, Eldon Strong and Dan Durnell, who feel that the county's borrowing way too much. They need to pay off their debt, which is now over $120 million and costs about $15 million a year to service principal and interest payments.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do they seem to feel about these necessary repairs, especially when you're talking about a 40-plus-year-old county government center?
Well, asbestos is a real concern.
Yeah.
The place was built in the 70s when asbestos was considered an acceptable insulation material. They've been scraping it out ever since, and apparently there's more to be done, I think, in the courts building. And old lighting that has to be replaced, and recently they've put down new flooring. There's all kinds of stuff. If you own a house, you know the score.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I've been over to the building here not long ago, and I saw they were doing a lot of work in the cafeteria area there. So they're continuing to do the improvements, I guess, as they can fit them into the budget.
Right.
Now, what's the process now as far as this bond issue is concerned?
Well, there's a 60-day the vote on Tuesday begins a 60-day remonstrance period where anybody from the public can essentially object to what will in essence be a tax increase to pay off this loan to be, and the elected officials have to consider any comments before they take a final vote probably sometime this summer.
Now, I know that Lake County Coroner Marilee Fry was one of the other big topics that came up at the council meeting this week, and it probably will come up again, I guess, at the next council meeting, next month, or unless there's a special meeting called in the meantime. So what did Coroner Fry have to say about the topic that she's most concerned about, which, of course, are overdose deaths?
She feels that there isn't enough research done on where these deadly drugs are coming from, whether they're being overprescribed by a doctor or illicitly coming from Chicago or wherever. So she wants to hire an OD analyst who would look at all of the pertinent information of the victim and what drug was in his body and have that information available for law enforcement and the public. For educational purposes as well.
Now, I understand that there wasn't a solid unanimous vote, at least when it came up here at this past meeting, to be able to get that analyst position set up here. I'm sure that Coroner Fry did the best to do her homework and get things together to try to let everybody on the council know that there was a need for this, certainly, and that it's not a brand new position that is to say that you're creating a position that exists in some other agency.
Well, that's just it. Councilman Eldon Strong objected. He voted no, and mm-hmm. And so the nothing could be done until next month. Next month's county council hearing. He argues that in essence the coroner's office is not a cop. In fact, the sheriff and in HIDA, the high intensity drug trafficking area, it's an investigative entity funded by federal dollars to handle drug cases. They do the same research with the coroner's information. So why do we need to hire one more person to do what he feels is the same thing? Mm-hmm. She convinced other council members that the State Board of Health, which keeps vital statistics, and the sheriff and HIDA have all sent letters saying we think this work is valuable. It won't repeat what we're doing. So it probably will go through a part-time employee, several thousands of dollars to look at this data.
Bill Dolan is the Lake County government reporter for the Northwest Indiana Times. Bill, thanks for spending time with us here on the Reporters Roundtable again today, and appreciate you passing along the information, some background into the stories that you worked on that are not only out there in print for people to pick up a copy of the paper or certainly see online as well, too. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
Bye.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and this is our Thursday Reporters Roundtable program, where we take a look at the big stories of Northwest Indiana for the week and the reporters from the newspapers and other media that worked on those stories and passed them along to us. And we have on the program for the first time, and we welcome on Carmen McCollum, who is the education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Carmen, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, you had a lot of stories to write this week, and a lot of it even goes back to the referendum that were set up here by the election people not long ago. But a lot of the news that you had written stories about and affect people in Northwest Indiana deal with this Gary Community School Corporation. Let's start talking first about that here. And you had a chance to listen in to some of the local lawmakers from Lake County that are the most affected by the Gary Community School Corporation's financial problems. Had a chance to meet with residents this past week. And tell us about how the meeting was set up and what were some of the things that were discussed.
Well, the meeting was set up where Indiana Senator Eddie Melton did an overview of the law. He did a very good job of going point by point, explaining to the audience, and there were more than 150 people there, explaining to the audience exactly what each section of that law meant, Senate Enrolled Act 567. There were some questions. In fact, they gave people an opportunity to write down their questions on index cards, and there were several questions, but they could not answer very many of them. There is, as you know, probably know, there is a follow-up meeting on May 15th, and it's going to take place at 5:30 p.m. at Westside Leadership Academy. Mm-hmm. That meeting will be hosted by the Distressed Unit Appeals Board, and that group will be better able to answer questions from the public.
Well, in fact, I know that Senator Melton's bill, which now has become law, is basically involving directly the what's called the DUAB for short, looking into the problems of the Gary Community School Corporation. And the bill and now the law sets up specifically how the state is going to be able to handle all this. From looking that over, what's your interpretation of how the Distressed Unit Appeals Board is going to be more directly involved with how the Gary Community School Corporation works?
I think that they'll be involved, but they'll still be sort of at arm's length. They'll have the final approval on all things because the emergency manager can pretty much determine what's going to happen, and he only has to provide that information to DUAB, or the Distressed Unit Appeals Board. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting. There have been a lot of people talking about it, about what exactly is going to happen. Will Gary play any role? Will Gary's leaders play any role in the decisions that's going to be made about the school district? It looks like Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson has already proposed that her representative on the fiscal board be the retired Senator Earlene Rogers. Mm-hmm. The Gary School Board will also have an opportunity to put someone on that board, but you have to remember that fiscal board is only an advisory board. They will not make any decisions.
Right. They basically talk about the matters and they'll make their recommendations to the emergency manager.
Yes.
And that person is the person that actually is in charge, I guess. I know that the question came up and I brought up when I had a chance to talk with Senator Melton here in the studio not long ago about what's going to happen with the Gary Community School Board as well as Superintendent Cheryl Pruitt. What's going to be her role and the board's role in all of this now that the matter is kind of turned over to the state?
That's a good question, and nobody knows the answer to that. Dr. Pruitt, I've asked her about that, and she believes she will still be in place. Mm-hmm. But nobody has definitively said, yes, she will be in place.
It looks like
maybe she will be in sort of an advisory role. Nobody is really sure about that right now. It's interesting. And there are a lot of people who are out there right now who are expressing some interest in overseeing and managing the Gary Community Schools.
Mm-hmm. I remember in talking with Senator Melton about this, I think maybe I even mentioned that I would imagine I was just kind of thinking out loud at the time and on the air about the fact that maybe the school board ought to be more spokespeople, so to speak, to tell the public all of the problems and explain to them how this fiscal management board is going to work and how they're going to try and deal with the problems that the Gary Community School System's gotten itself into and make a more transparent opportunity to the public.
I think the one of the things that legislation says is that they'll only meet once per month. You probably know that they were meeting, I think, Monday through Thursday on many days.
Yes.
Dr. Pruitt did cut some of that down when she came in, but there are still a tremendous number of meetings going on. So those things are going to change. I think their position will kind of be an advisory role, too. That's not spelled out in legislation. There's nothing that says they will advise any particular entity now that the state has taken over academics and finances.
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions that did come out because we've all had a chance to look at Senate Bill 567, now a law, that it doesn't say what role that the Gary Community School Corporation Board or the superintendent play in all of this too. So now does the DUAB, the DUAB, excuse me, do they have the opportunity? They're the ones, I guess, that are going to choose the emergency manager. They're going to, or the firm, I guess, however they work this out.
It looks like DUAB will choose the emergency manager.
Well, it sounds
people
like
people are applying for that. Companies are applying for that right now.
Well, that's why when I figured that they'll be if they're ones companies that are out there. In fact, I know that Jack Martin, the fellow who had been filling that position at least on a local level, so to speak, with the Gary Community School Board, that he's such a company, I guess, based out of Michigan because he had worked up there and advised, as we know, the Detroit Public Schools
and their
financial problems. So I'm sure that that's the next thing to find out who is the person or company that's going to be coming into Gary and doing a lot of work to deal with some of these issues as well, too. Do you think that the possibility is still there from what you know and the people you've talked to that the Distress Unit Appeals Board is going to be able to offer a bit more information at this meeting next Monday?
I hope so. We've all got questions. I've got plenty of questions myself on exactly how it's going to operate. I just recently heard that there is an Indianapolis charter operator who wants to manage the Gary schools. That person has not been identified yet.
Oh.
I'm guessing that it may, there is a, and I don't want to give any names because I'm not really sure who it is right now. I'm going to make some calls actually today to see if I can get some more information on that.
Does this sound out of the ordinary that the charter school, we know, of course, that we've had charter school companies have come in because that's been involved in Gary for many years now, dealing just with individual schools. You know,
right,
this is something,
right,
maybe something a bit different that you get a charter school organization, a company of some sort that actually takes over or tries to take over supervise the operations of an entire school district.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah,
it certainly is a possibility.
Okay. Let's move on here from looking at the Gary Community Schools to referenda, and we can also bring up, I guess we kind of delve back into the Gary Community Schools about this as well, too, in the conversation, but we know that just recently here, voters in Munster, in Lake Station, as well as in East Chicago, had a chance to speak out about their school corporation's request for additional tax money to be able to do various and sundry things. Tell us first what the school districts that had the referenda vote recently had sought, how the votes turned out.
Well, for Munster and Lake Station, both were able to pass their referendum. The school city of East Chicago did not pass the referendum. As you probably know, the school town of Munster had been initially in debt about $8 million. The new superintendent, Jeff Hendricks, was able to shave that down by about $3.5 million, where it's now around $4.5 million. The money, the referendum they had in 2013, will be replaced with the new general fund referendum, and this will likely pull them out of the hole. They've been concerned about the tax caps and how that's going to affect them in 2020, and probably they should be in great shape now that that referendum is passed. Mm-hmm. The construction referendum will allow them to repair their buildings and to make sure that they do everything necessary to upgrade technology and all of the many things that different schools want to do to make sure that they're keeping everything up to date for the students.
Okay.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, in Lake Station, they had a very successful one too, didn't they?
They did. They did not actually win by a lot of votes, but it was a successful referendum. Mm-hmm. I think the vote difference was something like 82 votes altogether.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It was something like just a little bit more than that. 482 yes to 399 no. So they did well. They got it passed, and that will allow them to make some changes in their transportation. They had been talking about possibly not offering bus service beginning in January 2018. That's off the table. They'll be fine. They had also talked about possibly closing a school. And they don't have to worry about that right now. They'll mm-hmm. be fine. Over that 7-year period, they'll raise about $5.6 million.
I got the impression in the conversation I had after the referendum vote from the Lake Station superintendent that while closing Polk Elementary is off the table for now, they still will consider it, I guess, if they have to do some trimming of expenses in the future. But they're hoping they don't have to, I know. That's
right.
The impression I got.
Exactly.
Now,
yeah.
Unfortunately, East Chicago has not been so lucky. They seem to be, unfortunately, a city that is behind the eight ball in at least a couple ways now. We know with the lead and arsenic contamination in one particular neighborhood, and now the entire school district has got some financial dealings they have to take care of. And some of it, I know, that they've had to deal with is related to the closing of one school because of the contamination. But I know that the superintendent, Paige McNulty, is working very hard now to try to figure out what to do next, I imagine.
Yes. She's busy looking at selling buildings. She's hoping to get a deal on the Carrie Gosh Elementary School, the former Carrie Gosh that was closed. Mm-hmm. She's hoping to get a deal on that. She has asked the legislature to forgive many issues, many loans that they've had, or to give them some more time to pay it off. She's come up with a lot of creative things in order to try to ease the burden that the school district is facing.
Now, I know that while this referendum was going on before the election actually happened, there has also been discussion that's come up and some public meetings as well, too, in some other communities and some other discussion that even you and I mentioned, talked about there briefly on election night as we were waiting for the referenda votes to come in, about some other school districts that may possibly go to their voters and ask for more money.
Yeah, and in fact, I'll be working on a story that will be in the paper sometime next week.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two or three additional districts that will be asking for a referendum. I'm not sure if their vote will come in November, if they'll do a special election, or if it will come the following May.
Right. Well, I know. Yeah, we know that there have been public meetings that the Hobart community school superintendent has been very proactive, I think, in many respects. She's probably taken the advice of Jeff Hendricks and Munster to be able to get out there and explain things in as much detail as possible to let people in her community know that there's a reason why we're asking for more funds, and that's why they're going about it. And I know that even we talked about the fact that although I don't know for sure if it's come up yet, the Gary Community Schools was thinking about going again before the voters in their community in another request for additional funding. I wonder if, in light of everything that has happened with the school district and the new law that's now in effect authorizing the state emergency manager and the financial advisory board, so to speak, I wonder if they're going to try again.
That'll be interesting. That's going to be, I think, up to DUAB whether or not they try that again. And it's going to really need an education process, a complete education process. And if they're interested, if they're thinking about that, as soon as that emergency manager is in, there will likely be some discussion about that if they are seriously thinking about going again. They've lost twice. They've not been able to pass it twice. So it was going to take some education of the entire community, very much going door to door and holding meetings to talk about it.
Okay. We're talking with Carmen McCollum, who is the education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Carmen, along with her colleagues, Joyce Russell and Sarah Reese, recently put out a story in the Times talking about how the region schools are involved in the lead and water testing process. Tell us how that story developed and the results of it.
Actually, Sarah Reese has been covering East Chicago for a while since the lead issue started.
Right.
So she initially got the information from the state about which schools were going to participate in the water testing. They sent out an email, I believe, and that would be the Indiana Finance Authority. They sent out an email to schools across the Northwest Indiana area and asked them if they wanted to participate in the free water testing. So many of them replied and responded. Some of them, I think, maybe the email went into their junk mail and they didn't get to it. But those of them who were not aware of it are now aware of it and checking to see what they can do to get on that list. It's free. It makes no sense not to do it. It makes every bit of smart. It's smart to go ahead and get that done. Check your water just to make sure that nothing is wrong, even though you don't expect it. When I talked to Tom Kripliver in Lake Station, he said he didn't expect to have any problems, but they were going to do it just to make sure that the quality of their waters was clean and safe.
It just makes sense here if you live in Northwest Indiana that even though you may have a utility that is very careful about these matters to make sure that the supply of water is safe, anything can happen between the time it comes out of the pumping station and gets to the lines to your house and to your tap. You've got to be sure that everything is safe and water is definitely clean, so it just makes sense to test it out too. Have you known of any people in particular in your neighborhood, so to speak, and people that you've talked to about this, that they if they haven't done it before, that they're going to, or if they have done the testing before, that they've maybe realized that we've got some problems, we've got to get them taken care of?
Yeah, I actually don't know anyone in my neighborhood who has, you know, talked about that or discussed that. Mm-hmm. The school district is on the list. They intend to have their water tested in the Crown Point Community School Corporation as well as the Maryville Community School Corporation. They both intend to have their water tested.
That's great. Carmen McCollum is the education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and she's been with us here on this Thursday's Reporters Roundtable discussion on Regionally Speaking. Thank you, Carmen, for all the time that you spent and the discussion here. We'll be looking forward to having a chance to talk with you again maybe next week after this DUAB meeting on Monday happens, and Gary, to find out what folks here from the people in Indianapolis as to how the new financial managers in the Gary Community School Corporation are going to handle things. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You are welcome. Thank you.
And let's turn now to some news on the state education scene. Eric Weddle is a reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting Station, WFYI, Public Radio in Indianapolis. And he had a chance to travel to Evansville to yesterday's Indiana State Board of Education meeting and some interesting issues that came up there. Eric, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start out first here, taking a look at the big list. Yeah. The most important thing I know that turned out into a separate story in particular you created a couple features, which we aired here on Regionally Speaking before yesterday's State Board of Education meeting, about a chronically failing virtual charter school. Tell us what the problems were involving Hoosier Academy's virtual school. I don't know if many people up here in Northwest Indiana have even heard of it.
The school does say that they have more than 3,200 students who represent each of the counties in the state. So there probably are some students around there. But yeah, it's been around since 2009. And they have really kind of suffered from a number of issues, one being a lot of turnover of students. A lot of students seem to enroll there. Maybe for 1 year, and often for only a few months. And they've had a big turnover, and that's led to the scores just not being that great. As you mentioned, they've been failing. They've earned 6 Fs from the state, and they've also had a lot of turnover of leadership there in its early years, which the current leader's been there for 3 years.
Jeez.
So the school leaders have really tried to kind of, you know, say that the problems that they're facing aren't really are more as a result of the different kind of student who attends there. Though there are a number of families who support the school and that I've talked to who are very happy there and are doing pretty well.
Well, it sounds like at least it's had some successes. And it's sad, though, that when you get to this situation that you become under the scrutiny of the State Board of Education here, and because you've had all these bad grades for so many years, you're not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be a more successful school, I suppose.
Right. It is. You know, and that was what the big debate yesterday was. So this is, you know, a charter school, and under state law, when a charter school gets 4 Fs from the state, they are then eligible to be sanctioned. And so 2 years ago, when they hit 4 Fs, the state board, the majority of the members said, well, we're going to give you some time to improve, and then please come back in a year, and we'll look at things then. Well, they didn't wait a year. They waited more than 2 years. And then during that time, one of the interesting things is the head of the school, a guy by the name of Byron Ernest, who's a pretty well-known educator around here, he was appointed to the state board. And so he was on the board that was actually going to be making a verdict on his school.
Indeed.
So when the school came to the board yesterday, he, of course, had recused himself, but there was a lot of frustration by the board members that the school hadn't really done much to make improvements in those past 2 years.
I suppose they could use that opportunity, even though he certainly couldn't vote on the matter, but at least to make sure that it's more of a sounding board for him, expressing their concerns and why he doesn't take that back to the school itself and say, we've got to do something better.
Right. I mean, so Ball State University is the authorizer for the school. They were there. And the school is managed by a for-profit company in Virginia by the name of K-12 Inc. And their CEO also came to kind of go to bat for the school. But it kind of turned out that the school just recently made an improvement plan in the past month or so. So the board was frustrated that in these 2 years since they originally addressed the school, this action plan was only made last month.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did the State Board of Education decide to do, actually?
So they have a number of options. One of them is to shut the school down totally. They could just say the school ends this year. No one seemed to want to do that. Instead, they decided to limit the enrollment next year. So they said, as of yesterday, the enrollment could not surpass the current number of students. And that number is 2,850, which is actually 400 less then started this school year. So basically, the school is going to lose out on 400 potential students when it opens up in the fall. They also forced the Ball State to return some of the money that the school pays them as a fee for being its authorizer.
Now, do you think that maybe that money coming back to the school might be a good idea, that it may actually be a benefit to the school?
I've spoken with Ball State about this before the meeting, and they had planned to, you know, invest the money in different types of professional development, you know, because they have a lot riding on this too as the authorizer and all these students, you know, that they kind of oversee. So I think that Ball State would have done this anyway, but now the state board kind of made it. The state board decided to do it because they felt Ball State was at fault as well.
Some of the other matters that came up before the State Board of Education at the meeting in Evansville yesterday, Eric Einstein was mentioned about this in some other stories as well, too, is something called the Choice Scholarship. How did that come up, and what's
right.
that all about?
Before I explain that, let me just give you one more kind of explanator into this. So
okay.
The state board has 11 members on it, 11 seats. Two members recently left the board. One became a lawmaker in your area, and then another joined the staff of the new superintendent. So that brought it down by two members. Governor Holcomb has not appointed those yet. So at yesterday's meeting, one other member was absent, so that brought it down to only seven members in the board. And a board vote must, six people must vote to approve something.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only have one person say no. So yesterday, this choice scholarship issue you're talking about is a law that was passed that allows private schools who receive school vouchers to pay for tuition. If they are graded a D or an F for consecutive years, they lose the ability to accept new students.
Wow.
Under the law previously, they were able to regain their eligibility over a number of years if they had improvements. This new law that the governor just signed allowed these schools to come before the state board and kind of request a waiver to become eligible much sooner if they could show some improvements.
Well, hopefully that is not going to spell any problems for them, at least for the scholarship program itself now. Shouldn't have any problems there.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The vote turned out to be didn't turn out to be a vote, as you say, because it didn't have enough people on the board to vote on it. So the board
was presented with this, and five members said yes, approved the waivers, and three members said no. And because of that, it failed. And those three schools that wanted the waivers did not get them. And then later on in the meeting, someone came to the board to speak, and they basically said this law had been written for these three schools in particular, and that they were very frustrated that the board had not been able to approve it. But, you know, like you said, there just weren't enough members. So it remains to be seen if these schools can come back next month or later in the year to try this again. The current law does not state if you're rejected, if you can come back or not. Mm-hmm. So that's open to interpretation.
We're talking with Eric Weddle, who is a reporter, covers education as well as other topics for Indiana Public Broadcasting stations, as well as his home base, which is WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis. He was at the State Board of Education meeting in Evansville yesterday to hear what was going on and the topics there. And I understand there was one more topic we'd like to talk briefly about, Eric, is about the iLearn plan. Tell us what that is and what the board thought.
Right. So iLearn, you know, is the replacement for the ISTEP test. You know, I think most people in Indiana probably have an opinion about the ISTEP and whether it works or not. And in this past legislative session, a bill was written to create a new test to replace that in 2 years from now. It's called the iLearn. But the law did not basically say what the iLearn was. It's only a framework. So yesterday, the State Board of Education brought that framework to the board. And basically, you know, it calls for the exam being what is so-called computer adaptive. And that means if a student's taking the test, if they start answering questions correctly, the questions get more difficult as they go along. And that is a means of kind of testing how much a student knows. If a student got questions wrong, the questions would not get any more difficult.
I guess that would probably be a way to get around the fact that, you know, that there's always been concern and criticism about teachers teaching students only for the tests alone.
Right. So I think, you know, that's kind of what this would do, just kind of go after that. So students would have to kind of be prepared to work a little bit harder on the exam. The law also makes the test happen only once a year. So right now, if you have kids in school, you know they take it twice in the second semester of the school. So basically, this framework was just brought to the board, asking them to approve it so the department can write a formal request, an RFP, a request for a proposal for testing companies around the country to submit their plan to make a new test.
Well, it sounds like that's going to be an interesting way to deal with it. We'll be looking for more stories, I'm sure, that you'll have out there about the iLearn plan as is coming out here. We find what the replacement test that students all across Indiana are going to be taking in their classrooms and in the months and years ahead. Eric Weddle is a reporter in Indianapolis. He's been covering, in this case, the State Board of Education meeting in Evansville for his home station, WFYI in Indianapolis, as well as for the Indiana Public Broadcasting stations. Eric, thank you for taking time to join us and talk about these topics that came up here, and we'll look forward to having a chance to have you back on to talk about some other issues in the future, too. Thank you today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And thank you very much for listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our thanks, as always, to our Thursday producer and assistant, Dee Dotson, working on the program today. Back with you on Monday. We hope you have a great weekend.